The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the New Yorker Hour on the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm Evan Mercer, and today, from the July 22, 2019 edition of the New Yorker magazine, I will read a short story by Hanif Qureshi and an article about why so many African-American families are losing their land. I'll begin today with a short story from the fiction section entitled She Said, He Said by Hanif Qureshi. Sushila was walking in the park when she saw Mateo and his male assistant sitting on a bench. As she approached them, she noticed that Mateo was disheveled in his black suit. In fact, he was very drunk, which was unusual for him at that time of day, late afternoon. She greeted him, kissing him on both cheeks, and he asked if she would sleep with him. Why hadn't they slept together, he went on. They could do it right now at his place, if she had time. He had always found her sexy, but had been too nervous to mention it. They had known each other for at least 18 years, but he had never spoken to her in this way. She was surprised and tried to seem amused. She had always liked him. Clever, witty, Mateo worked with her husband, Lynn. His wife, Marcy, was a confidant. They had all gone to the coast together. The next morning, she saw Mateo again in the supermarket, not with his assistant and not drunk. He came right over and repeated his remarks in almost the same words, adding that Sushila had been with Lynn for a long time and surely she was bored with him. Women liked variety, he said, and he was offering some. They should get together, even if it was only once. Nothing more need be said. Sushila kept her temper. She told Mateo that she would never sleep with him. Not in 1,001 lifetimes, not ever. If this was his idea of seduction, she wouldn't be surprised if he was still a virgin. Right away, she called Lynn and reported what Mateo had said on both occasions. Lynn was pale and agitated when he got home. He asked Sushila if she was okay, and then texted Mateo to say that he wanted to meet. Mateo responded. He was headed out of town, but he hoped that Lynn had some new artwork to show him. Could he come by, bring it by next week? Lynn had been drawing so well recently, his work had reached a new level. Mateo was surprised when Lynn arrived empty-handed. Where were the new drawings? 4 days had passed, and Lynn was now calm. He had discussed the matter with Sushila and could levelly report to Mateo what he had heard about his behavior, first when drunk in the park, and then when sober in the supermarket. Mateo apologized without reservation and asked Lynn to forgive him. But Lynn said that he didn't think he was ready to. Forgiving or even forgetting wasn't the point. He didn't understand why Mateo, whom Lynn thought he knew, had behaved in this way. Mateo said that he had had no idea either, but that it would be best if they put it behind them. Lynn asked Mateo why he had repeated the offer to Sushila when he was sober and smart enough to know better. And Mateo said that he hadn't wanted Sushila to think that he wasn't serious, that she wasn't really desired. Lynn thanked Mateo for his consideration. After their meeting, he walked around the park for a long time, unable to put the conversation out of his mind. Silence breeds poison, he thought. And what had happened pressed on him more and more until an idea occurred. He would discuss it with Mateo's wife, Marcy. She and Mateo were still married, but no longer together, living next door to each other as friends. Marcy had been seriously ill recently, but Lynn was keen to know whether she found her husband's seduction attempts ugly, crazy, or something else. Maybe he was having a breakdown? Or was he just an imbecile and Lynn had failed to notice? So Lynn went to see Marcy, who was convalescing in bed. Knowing that she had grown tired of Mateo's antics with other women when they were together, he felt that it wasn't wrong to tell her what Mateo had said to Sushila. Marcy knew Mateo. She might be objective. Having relayed the story, he added that during their conversations about it, Sushila had revealed new facts to him that he had been unaware of, which no one had told him. It turned out that in the past 2 years, Mateo had approached other female friends in a similarly crude way. Susan, for instance, had mentioned her experience with Mateo to Sushila, and Zora, too. Maybe there were others. Had Marcy also heard about his behavior? Lynn wanted to emphasize that, as Marcy knew, Sushila was kind, protective, and certainly no hysteric. It wouldn't be like her to make too much of the exchanges in the park and the supermarket. But she had been humiliated and demeaned by the encounters. What did she, Marcy, think of all of it? Although she listened, Marcy barely said anything. She didn't even move her head in an affirmative or a negative direction. Her self-control was remarkable. Usually when faced with a gap or silence in conversation, people babble. Not Marcy. When at last Lynn suggested that Mateo seek therapy and the source of his discontent, this was, these days, the generally accepted panacea for wrongdoing, Marcy said that Mateo had been in therapy for 20 years. Evidently those things took time, Lynn said. Well, they can do, Marcy murmured. When Lynn went home and told Sushila that he had gone to Marcy's place, she was angry with him. He wasn't her representative, she said. Why hadn't he discussed the plan with her first? She was the one it had happened to. It wasn't even his story. What did he think he was doing? Well, Lynn said that there had been nothing light or flirty about Mateo's approach as far as he understood it. Mateo had insulted him as a human being, too. He was entitled to take offense and seek an explanation, if not revenge. It wasn't often, he said, that you experienced deliberately inflicted cruelty. And from a friend. His view of Mateo, one of his oldest friends and someone whose advice he had always trusted, had changed for good. The insult was now general. It didn't belong to anyone, and it could happen again. Women were at risk. Lynn would hate himself if he didn't speak out. Sushila told Lynn that he was becoming fixated. It had been a lapse. Women had to put up with this kind of thing all the time. Not that she wasn't touched or impressed by Lynn's concern, but she didn't think Mateo would do it again. He was mortified by what he had said. His regret was genuine, and his behavior had obviously been self-destructive. Lynn said that self-destructive things were what people most enjoyed doing. Sushila agreed, adding that Mateo resembled a gambler who repeatedly risked his own security. She herself liked rock climbing, which at times put her life in danger, but Marcy would have a word with Mateo. Marcy was the only one who could get through to him. In the future, Mateo would hesitate, if only for Marcy's sake. Well, Lynn doubted that, and he didn't understand how Marcy could just sit there putting up with the embarrassment. But Sushila said, please, he knew Marcy was ill. It might be a good idea for him to apologize to her for intruding like that. Was he prepared to do that? Before he could begin to consider this, Sushila went further. She wanted to speak frankly now. Lynn could be a little conventional, if not earnest, at times in his ideas about love. He could? He inquired. How was that? Well, Marcy was celibate, and Mateo, they were coming to understand, might be a serial abuser. Otherwise, they might be the model contemporary couple. Despite everything, they were genuine companions with an unbreakable link that he, Lynn, couldn't grasp. No one had loved Marcy as Mateo had, and Marcy was devoted to Mateo. Even if he did something crazy now and then, which we all did at times, she stood by him. You had to respect that. Lynn mocked the idea of a passionless passion. It didn't make sense and was probably why Mateo was frustrated. Assaulting women made him feel potent. Sushila said that she didn't think that was it, but with regard to Marcy, she wanted to add that often we love others because of their weakness. And if we were able to keep all the crazy people from being crazy, well, who would want to live in that dull bureaucratic world? They had grown tired of discussing it. There was nothing to add, and the topic seemed to have been dropped from their lives when, a week later, an invitation arrived. Mateo's birthday was the following week, and they were invited to the celebration. Sushila went into town and spent an afternoon looking for a present. She asked Lynn to promise not to say anything. A party wasn't the time or the place. Lynn vowed to keep his mouth shut, adding that he would sulk a little and maintain his distance so that friends knew the incident had registered but wasn't killing him anymore. However, once they got to the party, Mateo, or at least a man who resembled him, approached Lynn immediately. Mateo had shaved his beard, cropped his hair, and seemed to have colored it. Before Lynn could discover if this was a disguise, Mateo put his arm around Lynn's shoulder and pressed his mouth to his ear. He wanted to have a word with him, over there, in a corner of the room. Would Lynn follow him, please? Lynn had told the story to many people, Mateo said. Someone in Mateo's office had even mentioned it. Now, exaggerated rumors were spreading. But hadn't Lynn accepted his apology and agreed to end the matter? Do you want to stab me in the heart and make my wife weep all night? Mateo said. She did that, okay? She cried after you walked right into her home and bullied her. And my assistant, standing over there, saw what happened in the park. He admits it was messy, but no more than that. Lynn pushed him away. Don't you stand so close to me, he said. You don't know what you're saying. You're actually a savage. What about Susan, Zora, and all the other women? Mateo replied that everyone knew that seduction was difficult these days. In these impossible times, courtship rituals were being corrected. In the chaos, those seeking love would make missteps. There would be misunderstandings, dark before light. Anger was an ever-present possibility. But it was essential that people try to connect, if only for a few hours, that they never give up on the need for contact. Otherwise, we would become a society of strangers. No one would meet or touch. Nothing would happen. And who would want that? Of course, Lynn was known in their circle to have issues with inhibition. If there was an opportunity to be missed, he'd miss it for sure. Didn't he dream repeatedly that he'd gone to the airport and all the planes had left? At least that was what he had memorably told everyone at supper one night. He was a born misser. Lynn told Sushila that he had to go out for some air, but once he was outside, he didn't want to go back. He felt as if he didn't quite recognize anything anymore. The world was stupid, and there was no way around that. He started to walk quickly away, but he knew that, however far he went, he'd have to come back to this place, if he could find it. And now, from the American Chronicles, an article by Lizzie Presser entitled, "The Dispossessed, Why Are So Many Black Families Losing Their Land?" In the spring of 2011, the brothers Melvin Davis and the Curtis Reels were the talk of Carteret County on the central coast of North Carolina. Some people said that the brothers were righteous. Others thought that they had lost their minds. That March, Melvin and LeCurtis stood in court and refused to leave the land that they had lived on all their lives, a portion of which had, without their knowledge or consent, been sold to developers years before. The brothers were among dozens of Reels family members who considered the land theirs. but Melvin and LeCurtis had a particular stake in it. Melvin, who was 64, with loose black curls combed into a ponytail, ran a club there and lived in an apartment above it. He'd established a career shrimping in the river that bordered the land, and his sense of self was tied to the water. LeCurtis, who was 53, had spent years building a house near the river's edge, just steps from his mother's. Their great-grandfather had bought the land 100 years earlier, when he was a generation removed from slavery. The property, 65 marshy acres that ran along Silver Dollar Road from the woods to the river's sandy shore, was racked by storms. Some called it the bottom or the end of the world. Melvin and LeCurtis's grandfather, Mitchell Reels, was a deacon. He farmed watermelons, beets, and peas, and raised chickens and hogs. Churches held tent revivals on the waterfront, and kids played in the river, a prime spot for catching red-tailed shrimp and crabs bigger than shoes. During the later years of racial segregation laws, the land was home to the only beach in the county that welcomed black families. "It was our own little black country club," Melvin and LeCurtis's sister Mamie liked to say. In 1970, when Mitchell died, he had one final wish. "Whatever you do," he told his family on the night that he passed away, "don't let the white man have the land." Mitchell didn't trust the courts, so he didn't leave a will. Instead, he let the land become heir's property, a form of ownership in which descendants inherit an interest, like holding stock in a company. The practice began during Reconstruction, when many African Americans didn't have access to the legal system, and it continued through the Jim Crow era, when black communities were suspicious of white Southern courts. In the United States today, 76% of African Americans do not have a will, more than twice the percentage of white Americans. Many assume that not having a will keeps land in the family. In reality, it jeopardizes ownership. David Dietrich, a former co-chairman of the American Bar Association's Property Preservation Task Force, has called heirs' property the worst problem you never heard of. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has recognized it as, quote, the leading cause of black involuntary land loss, end quote. Heirs' property is estimated to make up more than a third of Southern black-owned land, 3.5 million acres worth more than $28 billion. These landowners are vulnerable to laws and loopholes that allow speculators and developers to acquire their property. Black families watch as their land is auctioned on courthouse steps or forced into a sale against their will. Between 1910 and 1997, African Americans lost about 90% of their farmland. This problem is a major contributor to America's racial wealth gaps. The median wealth among black families is about a tenth that of white families. Now, as reparations have become a subject of national debate, the issue of black land loss is receiving renewed attention. A group of economists and statisticians recently calculated that, since 1910, black families have been stripped of hundreds of billions of dollars because of lost land. Nathan Rosenberg, a lawyer and researcher in the group, told me, "If you want to understand wealth and inequality in this country, you have to understand black land loss." By the time of Melvin and LeCurtis's hearing in 2011, they had spent decades fighting to keep the waterfront on Silver Dollar Road. They'd been warned that they would go to jail if they didn't comply with a court order to stay off the land, and they felt betrayed by the laws that had allowed it to be taken from them. They had been baptized in the water. "You going to go there, take my dreams from me like that?" LeCurtis asked on the stand. "How about it was you?" They expected to argue their case in court that day. Instead, the judge ordered them sent to jail for civil contempt. Hearing the ruling, Melvin handed his 83-year-old mother, Gertrude, his flip phone and his gold watch. As the eldest son, he had promised relatives that he would assume responsibility for the family. "I can take it," he said. Lycurgus looked at the floor and shook his head. He had thought he'd be home by the afternoon, even if his house was unlocked. The bailiff, who had never booked anyone in civil superior court, had only one set of handcuffs. She put a cuff on each brother's wrist and led them out the back door. The brothers hadn't been charged with a crime or given a jury trial. Still, they believed so strongly in their right to the property that they spent the next 8 years fighting the case from jail, becoming two of the longest-serving inmates for civil contempt in U.S. history. Land was an ideological priority for black families after the Civil War, when nearly 4 million people were freed from slavery. On January 12, 1865, just before emancipation, the Union Army General William Tecumseh Sherman met with 20 black ministers in Savannah, Georgia, and asked them what they needed. "The way we can best take care of ourselves is to have land," their spokesman, the Reverend Garrison Fraser, told Sherman. "Freedom," he said, "was placing us where we could reap the fruit of our own labor." Sherman issued a special field order declaring that 400,000 acres formerly held by Confederates be given to African Americans, what came to be known as the promise of 40 acres and a mule. The following year, Congress passed the Southern Homestead Act, opening up an additional 46 million acres of public land for Union supporters and freed people. The promises never materialized. In 1876, near the end of Reconstruction, only about 5% of black families in the Deep South owned land. But a new group of black landowners soon established themselves. Many had experience in the fields, and they began buying farms, often in places with arid or swampy soil, especially along the coast. By 1920, African Americans, who made up 10% of the population, represented 14% of Southern farm owners. A white supremacist backlash spread across the South. At the end of the 19th century, members of a movement who called themselves White Caps, led by poor white farmers, accosted black landowners at night, beating them or threatening murder if they didn't abandon their homes. In Lincoln County, Mississippi, white caps killed a man named Henry List, and more than 50 African Americans fled the town in a single day. Over 2 months, in 1912, violent white mobs in Forsyth County, Georgia, drove out almost the entire black population, more than 1,000 people. Ray Winbush, the director of the Institute for Urban Research at Morgan State University, told me, "There is this idea that most blacks were lynched because they did something untoward to a young woman. Well, that's not true. Most black men were lynched between 1890 and 1920 because whites wanted their land." By the second half of the 20th century, a new form of dispossession had emerged. Officially sanctioned by the courts and targeting heirs, property owners without clear titles. These landowners are exposed in a variety of ways. They don't qualify for certain Department of Agriculture loans to purchase livestock or to cover the cost of planting. Individual heirs can't use their land as collateral with banks and other institutions and so are denied private financing and federal home improvement loans. They generally aren't eligible for disaster relief. In 2005, Hurricane Katrina laid bare the extent of the problem in New Orleans, where 25,000 families who applied for rebuilding grants had heirs' property. One Louisiana real estate attorney estimated that up to $165 million of recovery funds were never claimed because of title issues. Heirs are rarely aware of the tenuous nature of their ownership. Even when they are, clearing a title is often an unaffordable and complex process, which requires tracking down every living heir, and there are few lawyers who specialize in the field. Nonprofits often pick up the slack. The Center for Heirs Property Preservation in South Carolina has cleared more than 200 titles in the past decade, almost all of them for African American families, protecting land valued at nearly $14 million. Josh Walden, the center's chief operating officer, told me that it had mapped out 100,000 acres of heirs property in South Carolina. He said that investors hoping to build golf courses or hotels can target these plots. We had to be really mindful that we didn't share those maps with anyone because otherwise they'd be a shopping catalog, he told me. And it's not as if it dries up. New heirs property is being created every day. Through interviews and courthouse records, I analyzed more than 36 cases from recent years in which heirs property owners lost land. Land that, for many of them, was not only their sole asset, but also a critical part of their heritage and their sense of home. The problem has been especially acute in Carteret County. Beaufort, the county seat, was once the site of a major refugee camp for freed people. Black families eventually built homes near where the tents had stood. But in the 1970s, the town became a tourist destination with upscale restaurants, boutiques, and docks for yachts. Real estate values surged, and out-of-town speculators flooded the county. David Soselski, a historian of the North Carolina coast, told me, "You can't talk to an African-American family who owned land in those counties and not find a story where they feel like land was taken from them against their will through legal trickery." Beaufort is a quaint town, lined with coastal cottages and colonial homes. When I arrived last fall, I drove 20 miles to Silver Dollar Road, where Melvin and Lucretius's family lives in dozens of trailers and wood-paneled houses scattered under pine and gum trees. Melvin and Lucretius's mother, Gertrude, greeted me at her house and led me into her living room, where porcelain angels lined one wall. Gertrude is tough and quiet, her high voice muffled by tobacco that she packs into her cheek. "It's because I didn't pay them no mind," she told me. The last of Mitchell Reel's children to remain on the property, she is the family matriarch. Grandchildren, nieces, and nephews let themselves into her house to pick up mail or take out her trash. Around dinner time, on the day I was there, the trickle of visitors turned into a crowd. Gertrude went into the kitchen, coated fish fillets with cornmeal, and fried them for everyone. Her daughter Mamie told me that Melvin and Lucretius had reveled in the land as kids, playing among the inky eels and the conch shells. In the evenings, the brothers would sit on the porch with their cousins, a rag burning to keep the mosquitoes away. On weekends, a pastor strode down the dirt street, robed in white, his congregants singing "Wade in the Water." Lucretius was a shy, humble kid who liked working in the cornfields. Melvin was his opposite. When the school bus showed up, when he come home, the crowd would come with him and stay all night, Gertrude said. When Melvin was 9, he built a boat from pine planks and began tugging it along the shore. A neighbor offered to teach him how to shrimp, and in the summer, Melvin dropped nets off the man's trawler. He left school in the 10th grade. His catch was bringing in around $1,000 a week. He developed a taste for sleek cars, big jewelry, and women, and started buying his siblings Chuck Taylors and Timberlands. Gertrude was the administrator of the estate. She'd left school in the 8th grade and wasn't accustomed to navigating the judicial system, but after Mitchell's death, she secured a court ruling declaring that the land belonged to his heirs. The judgment read, "The surviving 11 children or descendants of children of Mitchell Reels are the owners of the lands exclusive of any other claim of anyone." In 1978, Gertrude's uncle, Cedric Reels, tried to carve out for himself the most valuable slice of land on the river. He used a legal doctrine called adverse possession, which required him to prove that he had occupied the waterfront for years, continuously and publicly against the owner's wishes. Cedric, who went by Shade and worked as a tire salesman in New Jersey, hadn't lived on Silver Dollar Road in 27 years. But he claimed that tenants had stood in for him. He had built a house on the waterfront in 1950, and relatives had rented it or run it as a club at various times since then. Some figured that it was Shade's land. He also produced a deed that his father, Elijah, had given him in 1950, even though Mitchell, another of Elijah's sons, had owned the land at the time. Shade made his argument through an obscure law called the Torrens Act. Under Torrens, Shade didn't have to abide by the formal rules of a court. Instead, he could simply prove adverse possession to a lawyer whom the court appointed and whom he paid. The Torrens Act has long had a bad reputation, especially in Carteret. It's a legal way to steal land, Theodore Barnes, a land broker there, told me. The law was intended to help clear up muddled titles. But in 1932, a law professor at the University of North Carolina found that it had been co-opted by big business. One lawyer said that people saw it as a scheme, quote, whereby rich men could seize the lands of the poor, end quote. Even Shade's lawyer, Nelson Taylor, acknowledged that it was abused. He told me that his own grandfather had lost a 50-acre plot to Torrens. First time he knew anything about it was when somebody told him that he didn't own it anymore, Taylor said. That was happening more often than it ever should have. Mitchell's kids and grandkids were puzzled that Shade's maneuver was legal. They had Mitchell's deed and a court order declaring that the land was theirs, and they had all grown up on that waterfront. How can they take this land from us and we on it? Melvin said. We've been there all our days. Gertrude's brother Calvin, who handled legal matters for the family, hired Claude Wheatley III, the son of one of the most powerful lawyers in town, to represent the siblings at a Torrens hearing about the claim. Gertrude, Melvin, and his cousin, Raphael Reels, the only surviving heirs who attended the hearing, said that they left confident that the waterfront hadn't gone to Shade. No one in the family thought at the end of the day that it was his land and we were going to walk away from it forever, Raphael told me. Wheatley told me a different story. In his memory, the Torrens hearing was chaotic, but the heirs agreed to give Shade, who has since died, the waterfront. When I pressed Wheatley, he conceded that not all the heirs liked the outcome, but he said that Calvin had consented. I would have been upset if Calvin had not notified them, because I generally don't get involved in those things without having a family representative in charge, he told me. He said that he had never had a written agreement with Calvin, just a conversation. Calvin died shortly after the hearing. The lawyer examining Shade's case granted him the waterfront, and Wheatley signed off on the decision. The Reels family, though it didn't yet know it, had lost the rights to the land on the shoreline. Lacurtis had set up a trailer near the river a couple of years earlier in 1977. He was working as a brick mason and often hosted men from the neighborhood for Budweiser and beans in the evening. Melvin had become the center of a local economy on the shore. He taught the men how to work the water, and he paid the women to prepare his catch, pressing the soft crevice above the shrimp's eyes and popping off their heads. He had a son, little Melvin, and in the summers his nephews and cousins came to the beach, too. One morning he took eight of them out on the water and then announced that he'd made a mistake. Only four were allowed on the boat. He threw them overboard, one by one. "We're thinking we're going to drown," one cousin told me. "And then he jumps off the boat with us and teaches us how to swim." In 1982, Melvin and Gertrude received a trespassing notice from Shade. They took it to a lawyer who informed them that Shade now legally owned a little more than 13 acres of the 65-acre plot. The family was stunned and suspicious of the claim's validity. Many of the tenants listed to prove Shade's continuous possession were vague or unrecognizable, like Mitchell Reel's boy or Julian Leonard, whom Gertrude had never heard of. She had a sister named Julia and a brother named Leonard, but no memory of either one living on the waterfront. The lawyer who granted the land to Shade had also never reported the original court ruling that Gertrude had won, as he should have done. Shade's ownership would be almost impossible to overturn. There's a one-year window to appeal a Torrens decision in North Carolina, and the family had missed it by 2 years. Soon afterward, Shade sold the land to developers. The Reelses knew that if condos or a marina were built on the waterfront, the remaining 50 acres of Silver Dollar Road could be taxed not as small homes on swampy fields, but as a high-end resort. If they fell behind on the higher taxes, the county would auction off their property. "It would break our family right up," Melvin told me. "You leave here, you got no more freedom." This kind of tax sale has a long history in the dispossession of heirs' property owners. In 1992, the NAACP accused local officials of intentionally inflating taxes to push out black families on Dumfusky, a South Carolina sea island that has become one of the hottest real estate markets on the Atlantic coast. Property taxes had gone up as much as 700% in a single decade. It is clear that the county has pursued a pattern of conduct that disproportionately displaces or evicts African Americans from Dumfusky, thereby segregating the island and the county as a whole, the NAACP wrote to county officials. Nearby Hilton Head, which has, as recently as 2 decades ago, comprised several thousand acres of heirs' property, now, by one estimate, has a mere 200 such acres left. Investors fly into the county each October to bid on tax-delinquent properties in a local gymnasium. In the upscale town of Somerville, South Carolina, I met Rindy Reed, who in 2012 was late paying $83.81 in taxes on the lot she had lived on for nearly 4 decades. A former state politician named Thomas Limehouse, who owned a luxury hotel nearby, bought Reed's property at a tax sale for $2,000, about an eighth of its value. Reed had a year to redeem her property, but when she tried to pay her debt, officials told her that she couldn't get the land back because she wasn't officially listed as her grandmother's heir. She'd have to go through probate court. Here, she faced another obstruction. Heirs in South Carolina have 10 years to probate an estate after the death of the owner, and Reed's grandmother had died 30 years before. Tax clerks in the county estimate that each year they send about a quarter of the people who try to redeem delinquent property to probate court because they aren't listed on the deed or named by the court as an heir. Limehouse told me, "To not probate the estate and not pay the taxes shouldn't be a reason for special dispensation. When you let things go, you can't blame the county." Reed has been fighting the case in court since 2014. "I'm not leaving," she told me. "You'll have to pack my stuff and put me off." For years, the conflict on Silver Dollar Road was dormant, and Melvin continued expanding his businesses. Each week, Gertrude packed 2 pounds bags of shrimp to sell at the farmer's market, along with petunias and gardenias from her land. Melvin, who was also remodeling a nightclub, Fantasy Island, on the shore. "He decked it out with disco lights and painted it white," he said, "so that on the water it would shine like gold." The majority of the property remained in the family, including the land on which Gertrude's house stood. But LaCurtis had been building a home in place of his trailer on the contested waterfront. "It was the most pretty spot," he told me. "I'd walk to the water and look at my yard and see how beautiful it was." He'd collected the signatures of other heirs to prove that he had permission and registered a deed. When real estate agents or speculators came to the shore, Melvin tried to scare them away. A developer told me that once, when he showed the property to potential buyers, Melvin had a roof rack behind his pickup jumped out, snatched a gun out. It wasn't the only time that Melvin took out his rifle. "You show people that you got to protect yourself," he told me. "Any fool who wouldn't do that would be crazy." His instinct had always been to confront a crisis head on. When hurricanes came through and most people sought higher ground, he'd go out to his trawler and steer it into the storm. At 4 a.m. on a spring day in 2007, Melvin was asleep in his apartment above the club when he heard a boom like a crash of thunder. He went to the shore and found that his trawler, named Nancy J., was sinking. Yellow plastic gloves, canned beans, and wooden crab boxes floated in the water. There was a large hole in the hull, and Melvin realized that the boom had been an explosion. He filed a report with the sheriff's office, but it never confirmed whether an explosive was used or whether it was an accident, and no charges were filed. Melvin began to wake with a start at night, pull out his flashlight, and scan the fields for intruders. By the time of the brothers' hearing in 2011, Melvin had lost so much weight that Lycurgus joked that he could store water in the caverns by his collarbones. The family had come to accept that the dispute wasn't going away. If the brothers had to go to jail, they would. Even after the judge in the hearing found them guilty of civil contempt, Melvin said, "I ain't backing down." Lycurgus called home after that day. "It'll be all right," he told Gertrude. "We'll be home soon." One of the most pernicious legal mechanisms used to dispossess heirs' property owners is called a partition action. In the course of generations, heirs tend to disperse and lose any connection to the land. Speculators can buy off the interest of a single heir, and just one heir or speculator, no matter how minute his share, can force the sale of an entire plot through the courts. Andrew Carl, an associate professor of history and African American studies at the University of Virginia, told me that even if small financial incentives can have the effect of turning relatives against one another and developers exploit those divisions. You need to have some willing participation from black families driven by the desire to profit off their land holdings, Carl said. But it does boil down to greed and abuse of power and the way in which Americans' history of racial inequality can be used to the advantage of developers. As the Reels family grew over time, the threat of a partition sale mounted. If one heir decided to sell, the whole property would likely go to auction at a price that none of them could pay. When courts originally gained the authority to order a partition sale, around the time of the Civil War, the Wisconsin Supreme Court called it an extraordinarily and dangerous power that should be used sparingly. In the past several decades, many courts have favored such sales, arguing that the value of a property in its entirety is greater than the value of it in pieces. But the sales are often speedy and poorly advertised and tend to fetch below market prices. Thomas W. Mitchell, a property law professor at Texas A&M University School of Law, has drafted legislation aimed at reforming this system, which is now passed in 14 states. He told me that heirs' property owners, particularly those who are African American, tend to be land rich and cash poor, making it difficult for them to keep the land in a sale. They don't have the resources to make competitive bids, and they can't even use their heirs' property as collateral to get a loan to participate in the bidding more effectively, he said. His law, the Uniform Partition of Heirs' Property Act, gives family members the first option to buy, sends most sales to the open market, and mandates that courts, in their decisions to order sales, weigh non-economic factors, such as the consequences of eviction and whether the property has historic value. North Carolina is one of eight states in the South that has held out against these reforms. The state also hadn't repealed the Torrens Act. It is one of a fewer than a dozen states where the law is still on the books. The first time I met Melvin and Lycurgus in the Carteret jail, Melvin filled the entire frame of the visiting room window. He is a forceful presence and prone to exaggeration. His hair, neatly combed, was streaked with silver. He didn't blink as he spoke. The Curtis had been given a diagnosis of diabetes and leaned against a stool for support. He still acted like a younger brother, never interrupting Melvin or challenging his memory. He told me that at night he dreamed of the shore, of storms blowing through his house. The water rising, LaCurtis said, and I couldn't do nothing about it. He was worried about his mother. If they took this land from my mama at her age and she'd been farming it all her life, you know that would kill her, he told me. The brothers were seen as local heroes for resisting the court order. They want to break your spirits, their niece Kim Duhone wrote to them. God had you both picked out for this. Even strangers wrote. When I was a kid, it used to sadden me that the white folks had Radio Island, Atlantic Beach, Seagate, and other places to swim, but we didn't, one letter from a local woman read. She wrote that when she was finally taken to Silver Dollar Road, I remember seeing nothing but my own kind, black folks. In North Carolina, civil contempt is most commonly used to force defendants to pay child support. When the ruling requires a defendant to pay money other than child support, a new hearing is held every 90 days. After the first 90 days had passed, Melvin asked a friend in jail to write a letter on his behalf. Melvin couldn't read well, and he needed help writing. I've spent 91 days on a 90-day sentence, and I don't understand why, the letter read. Please explain this to me so I can go home back to work. Sincerely, Melvin Davis. The brothers learned that although Billy Dean Brown's lawyer had asked for 90 days, the court had decided that there would be no time restriction on their case and that they could be jailed until they presented evidence that they had removed their homes. They continued to hold out. Brown wasn't demolishing their buildings while they were incarcerated, and so they believed that they still had a shot at convincing the courts that the land was theirs. That fall, Brown told the Charlotte Observer, I made up my mind. I will die and burn in hell before I walk away from this thing. When I reached Brown recently, he told me that he was in an impossible position. We've had several offers from buyers, but once they learned of the situation, they withdrew, he said. 3 months turned into 6, and a year turned into several. Jail began to take a toll on the brothers. The facility was designed for short stays, with no time outside and nowhere to exercise. They couldn't be transferred to a prison because they hadn't been convicted of a crime. Early on, Melvin mediated fights between inmates and persuaded them to sneak in hair ties for him. But over time, he stopped taking care of his appearance and became withdrawn. He ranted about the stolen land, though he couldn't quite nail down who the enemy was, Shade or Wheatley or Brown, the sheriffs or the courts or the county. The brothers slept head to head in neighboring beds. Melvin would say crazy things, LaCurtis told me. Lay on down and go to sleep, wake up and say the same thing again. It wore me down. Melvin is proud and guarded, but he told me that the case had broken him. I'm not ashamed to own it, he said. This has messed my mind up. Without the brothers, Silver Dollar Road lost its pulse. Mamie kept her blinds down. She couldn't stand to see the deserted waterfront. At night, she studied her brother's case, thumbing through the court files and printing out the definitions of words that she didn't understand, like rescind and contempt. She filled a binder with relatives' obituaries so that once her brothers got out, they would have a record of who had passed away. When Claude Wheatley's father died, she added his obituary. I kept him for history, she told me. Gertrude didn't have the spirit to farm. Most days she sat in a tangerine armchair by her window, cracking peanuts or watching the shore like a guard. This winter, we looked out in silence as Brown's caretaker drove through the property. Melvin and LaCurtis wouldn't allow Gertrude to visit them in jail. LaCurtis said that it hurt so bad to see her leave. Other members of the family, Melvin and LaCurtis's brother Billy, their nephew Roderick, and their cousin Sean, kept trying to shrimp, but the river suddenly seemed barren. It might sound crazy, but it was like the good Lord put a curse on this little creek, where ain't nobody going to catch no shrimp until they're released, Roderick told me. Billy added, it didn't feel right no more with Melvin and them not there, because we all looked out for one another. Some mornings, you didn't even want to go. Sheriff's deputies came to the property a few times a week, and they wouldn't allow the men to dock their boats on the pier. One by one, the men lost hope and sold their trawlers. Sean took a job at Best Buy, cleaning the store for $11.50 an hour, and eventually moved to Newport, 30 miles southwest, where it was easier to make rent. Billy got paid to fix roofs, but soon defaulted on the mortgage for his house on Silver Dollar Road. "One day you good, and the next day you can't believe it," he told me. Roderick kept being charged with trespassing for walking on the waterfront, and he was racking up thousands of dollars in legal fees. He'd recently renovated his boat, putting in an aluminum gas tank, large spotlights, and West Marine speakers. But without a place to dock, he saw no way to hold on to it. He found work cutting grass and posted his boat on Craigslist. A white man responded. They met at the shore, and as the man paid, Roderick began to cry. He walked up Silver Dollar Road with his back to the river. He told me, "I just didn't want to see my boat leave." The Reels brothers were locked in a hopeless clash with the law. One judge, who heard their case, likened them to the Black Knight in Monty Python and the Holy Grail, who attempts to guard his forest against King Arthur. Even after King Arthur has cut off both of the Black Knight's arms and legs, he still insists that he will continue to fight and that no one may pass, although he cannot do anything, the judge wrote in an appeals court dissent. In February, nearly 8 years after Melvin and Lycurtis went to jail, they stood before a judge in Carteret to request their release. They were now 72 and 61, but they remained defiant. Lycurtis said that he would go back on the property just as soon as I walk out of here. Melvin said, "I believe that land is mine." They had hired a new lawyer who argued that it would cost almost $50,000 to tear down the brothers' homes. Melvin had less than $4,000 in the bank. Lycurtis had nothing. The judge announced that he was releasing them. He warned them, however, that if they returned to their homes, they'd be right back in jail. He told them, "The jailhouse keys are in your pockets." An hour later, the brothers emerged from the sheriff's department. Melvin surveyed the parking lot, which was crowded with friends and relatives. "About time," he said, laughing and exchanging hugs. "You stuck with me." And when he spotted little Melvin, who was now 39, he extended his arm for a handshake. Little Melvin pulled in closer and buried his face in his father's shoulder, sobbing. When Lycurtis came out, he folded over as if his breath had been pulled out of him. Mamie wrapped her arms around his neck, led him to her car, and drove him home. When they reached Silver Dollar Road, she honked the horn all the way down the street. "Back on Silver Dollar Road," Lycurtis said, pines flickering by his window. Melvin spent his first afternoon shopping for silk shirts and brown leather shoes and a cell phone that talked to him. Old acquaintances stopped him, a man who thanked him for his advice about hauling dirt, a DJ who used to spin at Fantasy Island. While in jail, Melvin had been keeping up with his girlfriends, and 11 women called looking for him. Melvin told me that he'd held on for his family and for himself, too. But away from the others, his weariness showed. He acknowledged that he was worried about what would happen, his voice almost a whisper. "They can't keep on doing this. There's got to be an ending somewhere," he said. A few days later, Gertrude threw her sons a party, and generations of relatives came. The family squeezed together on her armchairs, eating chili and biscuits and lemon pie. Mamie gave a speech. "We gotta get this water back," she said, stretching her arms wide. "We gotta unite. A change only as strong as the links in it," the room answered. "That's right." And the brothers who were staying with their mother kept saying, "Once we get this land stuff sorted out..." Relatives who had left talking about coming back, buying boats and go-karts for their kids. It was less a plan than a fantasy, an illusion that their sense of justice could overcome the decision of the law. The brothers had stepped onto the water, excuse me, the brothers hadn't stepped onto the waterfront since they'd been back. The tract was 100 feet away, but out of reach. Fantasy Island was a shell, the plot around it overgrown. Still, Melvin seemed convinced that he would restore it. "Put me some palm trees in the sand and build some picnic tables," he said. After the party wound down, I sat with a Curtis on his mother's porch as he gazed at his house, which was moldy and gutted, its frame just visible in the purple dusk. He reminisced about the house's wood-burning heater, the radio that he'd always left playing. He said that he planned to build a second story and raise the house to protect it from the floods. He wanted a wraparound deck and big windows. "I'll pour them walls solid all the way around," he said. "We'll bloom again. Ain't gonna be long." And now from the shouts and murmurs section, a small passage from This Password is Invalid by Claire Friedman. Thank you for creating your new online account. Please choose a password. Password: love dogs. Error: password must contain at least 9 alphanumeric characters, including one number. Password: I love my dog, too. Error: password must contain at least 1 hard-to-guess number. Password: I love my dog, 8. Getting warm, but not quite. Password: I love my dog, 88. Uh-oh, getting colder. Password: my dog is my best friend, 1. Error: yeah. Password must be less sad. Password: my dog is a good friend, 1. Error: password must not somehow be even sadder. Password: I have human friends, 1. Error: password must not contain refutable, bald-faced lies. Well, we've run out of time for today's broadcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed reading it. You have been listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and/or print impaired. Today's broadcast, as well as all previous New Yorker readings, are available as podcasts at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. For comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That's it for today. Until next time, this is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.